We have laws recognized by the United Nations on the freedom of the seas that allow any merchant to trade without being called a pirate. In many ways, the history of the internet followed a similar pattern. And I think today with Bitcoin, the history of money is following a similar pattern.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledin. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. Bitcoin is a disruptive asset, and it is reshaping how we think about money, politics, and even human rights. But Bitcoin wasn't the first disruptive asset or protocol in human history. There's been plenty. Electricity, the internet, planes, trains, and automobiles have all reshaped human history and culture. How did these technologies come to be? In today's show, we're going to dive into the history of disruption and decentralization. And our guest has literally written the book on that. J.P. Verne is not your typical academic. As the author of The Pirate Organization, Lessons from the Fringes of Capitalism, and a dedicated researcher exploring capitalism's evolution within the nexus of technology and decentralization, JP brings a fresh perspective to the table. Every time I talk to him, I feel like I learned something new. Today, we'll be discussing pirates, decentralized autonomous organizations, or DAOs, and the integration of Bitcoin into modern-day curriculums. Many of us missed the opportunity to study Bitcoin during our university years, but people like JP Verne are making sure that future Bitcoiners can get an early start to their education. Without further ado, here's my conversation with JP Verne. JP, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been it's long overdue for us to catch up, and I've always wanted to get you on the show since we started it last season. How are you?
I'm doing great, Maurizio, and it's great to contribute to the show. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
For those who don't know, JP was our first advisor, or one of our first advisors at Ledin, and he has some really interesting firsts in the Bitcoin and blockchain world in Canada in particular, and we'll get into all of that. I like starting the show getting into people's upbringings and how they grew up. So my first question to you is, what was it like growing up like JP Verne?
I guess it was very French. So I grew up in a bunch of mid-sized cities in the north of France. Kept moving around a lot because my dad was in the army. And so every few years we had to move to the next town. And so to this day, I struggle when people ask me where I'm from because I don't have much of a hometown back in France, or I have several, or I have plenty. For the past 20 years, though, I haven't lived in France because I very soon left the country to study internationally, lived in various places. I've lived in Belgium, I've lived in the Netherlands, in the US, and then I spent almost 10 years in Canada, spent a bunch of time in Latvia as well, and the last couple of years I've been in the UK.
My follow-on questions from this, and I can already start seeing the trend of you and internationalism, which is a common trend among a lot of Bitcoiners, is this concept of seeing the world and exploring the world and then seeing Bitcoin and understanding what it was, largely as a product of having seen so many different things and connecting dots and challenging different narratives as you moved around. So among the core tenets of Bitcoiners as well are events or experiences related to finance or properties. So we'll start with finance. Was it a big theme around your family? Did your parents talk to you a lot about money? Or was that something that came up later in life?
It was not. Not because we had plenty of it, but because it was not a topic that would be often discussed in an average middle-class family in France back then. And so the topic of money came into my life later, as I became a business person. I graduated from a business school, worked in the corporate world for a few years, and then went back to school to get a PhD and become a researcher in the field of management and organizational strategy. And I've been teaching about business since then and doing research in the space since then. And so in some ways, and it's a bit unusual, I started teaching about money before I fully understood it myself. And it's such a fascinating and complex topic because it is historically the foundations of communication between people who live in different places. The earliest evidence of accounting that we have and people counting money is also the earliest evidence we have of written language, written words. And so there's always been this very tight connection between money and communication between people. It's such a multi-layered topic. And, you know, once I fell into the topic of money, you have to get into history. You have to get into comparing cultures. You have to get into economics. You have to get into business. It's really like the Pandora's box to understanding how the world functions.
Pandora's box is the perfect analogy to describe it. When you start to look at the history of economics and money, what you'll find will certainly surprise you. Once you read through history, you'll learn that credit is older than coined money itself. Before coined money was a thing, people were lending each other seeds and cattle, sometimes backed by gold collateral, and that was as early as 3000 BC in ancient Mesopotamia. As you can see, these concepts are not new. Economics has an incredibly intricate and complex history that I encourage you to look into. But before we discuss more about the history of money with JP, I wanted to learn about his personal experiences and what led him to where he is today.
I guess my personal experiences include the experience of moving from one country to the next and realizing that what you think should be easily moving alongside with you, such as, you know, a balance in a bank account, is actually a very complex, intricate process with layers of regulations that are often opaque and intricacies that can, you know, take weeks or months to resolve. It's really a realization of the fact that money is very rarely yours. As soon as it's custodied by someone, you basically have that someone, typically a financial institution, act as a custodian that must authorize movements alongside one or more governments that are involved in the process, particularly when you're moving money across borders. And so in many ways, a bank account is a multi-signature wallet where you need two out of three parties to agree for a transaction to be allowed. And that's the account holder. So that would be me. And then there's a bank and then there's a government. And as long as you don't have two out of those three parties agreeing to a transaction, it doesn't happen. And so moving around and traveling, you realize that money is a lot more complicated and a lot stickier than what most financial institutions would advertise. You know, oh, just one click and you can send your money to a different account. It often works like this until you start moving around. Another interesting experience I had recently with property rights is looking at the real estate property system in the United Kingdom and trying to acquire some real estate in this country is an incredibly tedious experience. To put it simply, the real estate sector in the UK, or in England, to be more specific, is not yet capitalist. It is still part of the feudal system that prevailed in the Middle Ages, whereby there is a series of landlords, multiple layers of landlords that are sitting between you and the king, and that these different layers of landlordship need to be cleared going through various regulations that are still in place today, and some of which date back to the 12th century, the 14th century. And so in England today, you can acquire real estate property and become a landlord, and yet you still have a landlord above you, and sometimes you have several. And that was the system that prevailed in the Middle Ages, and it is still in place today, for the most part, in England. that system was abolished in other parts of the UK. So in Scotland, for instance, that system has been abolished a few years ago, but it's still in place in England. And realizing that was just like traveling back in time, but like much further back in time than I would have ever imagined. And so to be able to understand real estate property in England, I had to read regulations that were written 7 centuries ago and then had never been updated. And that was quite a realization. I did not expect that from a country that is in so many ways at the cutting edge of economic development and finance.
It looks like, at least from abroad or as an spectator, it looks like England would be a country with strong-ish property rights. I guess if you're a landlord, that's probably true. If you're one of the OG landlords, you know, that's probably true. And maybe it's designed to protect the interests of some property holders and maybe not others, which is very conducive to Bitcoin. Maybe backtrack for a minute. And you went to school to become a researcher. Did you know you wanted to be a researcher when you went into university, or did this come at your postgraduate? Like, what was your sort of journey through academics when you decided you wanted to prepare yourself to be a professor?
It came a bit later in my life. I got a regular business school degree, started working for large corporations, did some strategy consulting, very much enjoyed it, but soon enough realized that the part that was most exciting to me was the big picture strategic thinking and the background research where you uncover trends over time rather than execution. And that's what motivated me to dig deeper and go back to university, get a PhD, which I got from HEC Paris. The main theme of my PhD, and that's where my identity as a researcher was shaped, is actually involving situations where property rights are breached in various ways, or situations where property rights are undefined. And I started studying a number of industries where pirates or criminal organizations were involved, and their involvement led to innovation and led to industry rules being defined.
Before we continue, I wanted to take a second to define what JP means when he refers to pirates. Because the concept of a pirate means much more than the rebel sailors wearing eye patches that most people think of. Pirates represent an idea that goes far beyond the high seas, and they have everything to do with disruption and capitalism. In JP's view, pirates are innovators, disruptors, and agents of change who operate outside the conventional norms. They challenge established systems and push the boundaries of what's possible, often paving the way for new ideas and practices to emerge. Pirates embody the spirit of rebellion and creativity that drives progress and disruption in business, technology, and the economy.
And that's what I've been studying for the past 10 years, looking at, you know, to take a very recent example, for instance, how a startup like Uber in its early days entered a number of markets and its presence in those markets was deemed illegal for the most part because there were rules in place that gave a monopoly on the exercise of a particular profession to taxi companies. And that led to massive movements of rebellion across countries a few years ago. In Spain, for instance, the taxi drivers were protesting Uber and calling Uber drivers pirates. And that's a recent example of this movement where we see existing monopolies facing pirate disruptors. But if you look at this particular interaction, you see that it's actually happening over and over again across the history of capitalism, starting with the high seas pirates in the 17th century when international trade became a thing.
It's a fascinating concept, this idea that pirates are disruptors and that pirates are the best disruptors, in fact, or they were the first disruptors. And, you know, not to give away your book, I highly suggest everybody buys it and reads the whole thing, but how would you describe the book?
Yeah, so thanks, Maurizio, for the promotion. The book is actually, is available online, I hear, as a pirate copy as well. So it need not be bought. So the book is at the same time a history of capitalism since the 17th century and a history of piracy. And the main point of the book is that the birth and evolution of any industry can be analyzed by looking at the interaction between three different parties: the state, monopolies, and pirate disruptors. The book starts with the observation that capitalism and the nation state actually appeared at the same time, and that it's very, very hard to disentangle the two, or even imagine that we could have a capitalist society without a state. There's no instance of a capitalist society without a state in history. The role that nation states play in history when it comes to economic development is the role of a referee in many ways that has to arbitrate conflict between established monopolies, which are used to conquer new markets, and piratical disruptors that are contesting the dominance of those players on those markets. To pick an example that's the most ancient one, in the early days of the 17th century, a few innovations came about almost at the same time. The nation state, like I said, the public corporation with tradable shares as we know it today. So that was the East India Company in the United Kingdom, but also in Amsterdam, the Dutch East India Company. The stock exchange, the first stock exchange, was created at around the same time. And then the first central bank, right? So these foundational institutions of capitalism appeared at the same time. And that's why I do believe that capitalism appeared back then in the first 10, 15 years of the 17th century. Those institutional pillars, we still have them today. They haven't changed, right? So there's been an incredible amount of stability in the way capitalist societies are structured. But on that basis, there's been new industries, new markets, new spaces that have been opened up for economic exchange, starting with the high seas. New navigation techniques, international trade starts to expand. What do nation states do? They create monopolies. And all these big trade companies, the West India companies, the East India companies, etc., in the early 17th century, are monopolies. And these companies are claiming ownership. They're claiming property rights on the sea routes that they claim to have discovered, quote unquote, between Europe and faraway destinations in Asia, in Southeastern Asia. And basically, any merchant that is local and tries to trade on or around those routes is called a pirate by the European state monopolies. And the reason is that there's this conflict around ownership of the seas, with the European monopolies claiming you can own the seas, and the pirates saying, no, you don't have to, they should be a public good. There's been about two centuries of conflict around that. And eventually, we have agreed, we have recognized, using nation states as referees in the process, that the high seas should be best conceived of as free. And so now we have laws recognized by the United Nations on the freedom of the seas that allow any merchant to trade without being called a pirate. In many ways, the history of the internet followed a similar pattern. And I think today with Bitcoin, the history of money is following a similar pattern.
I could not agree more. And as you're speaking, I can already see or draw the overlaps in my head about just, you know, the similarities between how pirates disrupted those shipping lanes is very similar to how Uber disrupted taxis, and it's very similar to how the internet disrupted TV, and it's very similar to how Bitcoin is disrupting money and how companies like Ledin are frankly disrupting the banking system. It's an analogous that plays on over and over again with history doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes. And that was one of the things that I found so powerful about this book, which is that you were able to draw that sort of analogy or that metaphor all the way back to pirates. And one thing that actually, because I studied a little bit about money and I've also been very interested about money and speculation and money banking and speculation and how the three kind of interplay. And funny enough, in 1725, I think it was 4 or 5 years, around the same time that the first stock exchange was built, the first casino was also built. So I just think it's an interesting fact that with money comes property rights, with money comes speculation, with money comes saving, with money comes a lot of things that are just, you know, impact culture and impact the way we do everything, frankly. So you were already a fan of decentralization from what I can see before Bitcoin existed. You know, the concept of pirates is directly at odds with the concept of centralization. So, you know, clearly you were not a fan of centralization, or you thought there was something better a better way of disrupting things. And so where in this journey does Bitcoin come into your life?
I encountered it as I was researching the history of piracy when I was working on this book in 2012, I think 2012. I was at the time doing some research on the cypherpunks and their role in shaping the rules of the internet in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. And read a lot about them, talked to some people who were involved in the movement, and looked into some of the cryptographic tools that they were developing back then that was really, you know, all about public key encryption. And I was fascinated by the fact that at the time, cryptography in the United States was considered a weapon. And so when hackers that were part of the cypherpunks were emailing each other across borders to talk about this open source code that they were developing involving public key encryption, they were essentially, from the viewpoint of the US government, illegally exporting weapons. And so on that basis, many of them were arrested. There was an event called the Hacker Crackdown, where a bunch of them were arrested in the US in the early 90s. And interestingly, I realized that some of the building blocks in terms of the software that they had been working on in the early 90s inspired, years later, a mysterious Satoshi Nakamoto, who had built this thing called Bitcoin. And that's how I heard about Bitcoin in 2012. And for me, it was a very interesting discovery. I didn't enter the Bitcoin world through the lens of finance or freedom, like many people have, but really through the lens of the history of piracy and the open source movement in the hacker communities that were opposing the monopolies of the time on the internet. And those monopolies in the US were historically AT&T in the 70s and 80s, and then later on Microsoft. And when I realized that these pieces of software that were developed by those hackers could potentially challenge the monopoly of central banks, I thought, wow, this is really fascinating, because it shows again that same pattern. And when you think about it, the monopoly of central banks on the emission of money is kind of one of the last few monopolies that nation states have. You know, they used to have a monopoly on the use of legitimate violence with their armies, but we've seen in recent years that, you know, private armies have been relied on by the US with Blackwater a few years ago, by Russia with Wagner these days. So there's not even a monopoly on the use of legitimate violence by states anymore, but there's still this monopoly on the emission of money that, you know, Bitcoin is challenging.
So when you learn about this from the cryptographers as you were researching this book, at what point did you decide that you want to make a career out of researching this technology? Or what point between, how was the journey between finding out about Bitcoin, learning about it, and then making it your passion and going on to, you know, research this field, teach people about this? And, you know, we'll get into all the great work that you're doing, but around Bitcoin and academia, but how do you, you know, what was that journey like from discovering Bitcoin to saying, this is what I want to teach, this is what I want to do?
I was very excited by Bitcoin. And at the time, I was lucky enough to be living near Toronto, where a bunch of people were working on the launch of Ethereum. And so I remember meeting some of the co-founders of Ethereum before the launch, at the time where they were, all they had was a tiny office in downtown Toronto that was called Bitcoin Decentral. It was like, you know, 200 square feet, and they were working on this. And so I was like, wow, that's funny, because, you know, I just found out about this new exciting thing and blockchain technology, and then there's this big project, or so it seems, that's just, 2 hours away from where I was living at the time, which was London, Ontario, near Toronto. And I thought, okay, this is really cool, but maybe this is just much ado about nothing. It took me time to realize the significance of what was going on. And so I thought, you know, before engaging into like massive academic research effort around this, I thought, I'm just going to talk about this to my students at Ivy Business School and see if it, you know, if it piques their interest. And so what I did is I developed a teaching case on Bitcoin. I think it was in 2014. And I believe it was the first, Harvard style teaching case developed on Bitcoin. And I started teaching that in an elective course on the history of piracy and capitalism. And it was really exciting to see students' reaction when exposed to this topic. There was like massive excitement around this. And the class was, you know, very practical. Like, I would have every student set up a wallet, and I would send every student a little bit of, you know, Bitcoin during the class. And everybody would like receive some and make a transaction. And sometimes it wouldn't work because, you know, the university Wi-Fi would block applications related to cryptocurrency. And sometimes it wouldn't work because, you know, it would take like too long for each transaction to be processed. But at the end of the day, it created this sense of excitement around something really new. And I taught this class for a few years, starting in 2014. And I know some of my former students went on to start businesses in Canada in the crypto space, having been exposed to this early on. When I got confirmation that there was something around this that was built to last, and there were a lot of excited students who wanted to become entrepreneurs in the space, and that includes, you know, people that I met later on, like you and Adam, who founded Ledin. I thought, okay, this thing is not going away, and that's when I started doing academic research proper on the topic, raised some funding, research grants from the Canadian government, and starting working with PhD students. Spent years researching this new wave of decentralization that was affecting money and what the consequences of blockchain technology could be for management and the economy more broadly.
That's actually fascinating, because now we're getting at the point in the journey where our paths cross. I think this is right around the time where I reached out to you, I believe, because I saw that you were the only person in my alma mater, and I was looking for people to speak with about this, because I was just coming to Canada, setting up my miners, and you had written a few papers about Bitcoin or decentralization. And I reached out to you to connect, to just chat. And I then learned that you were teaching at the time, what I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was the first PhD graduate that was going to graduate under a blockchain title. So how the hell did you do that?
Well, so I believe Yin-Yang was the first PhD student to work on blockchain in the field of management, so in a business school. And she's now a professor of strategy at Imperial College Business School in London, UK. So we're back living in the same town. I think there was something special about and interesting for me about Ivy Business School. It's a bit like the Harvard Business School of Canada. And with that comes also the weight of the past, the weight of history, and a certain form of conservatism on the surface. And yet, despite that, it's a school where a lot of people, students, faculty members, alumni, can get together and work on crazy cutting-edge stuff. And so there's this tension between like a very traditional conservative environment that enables cutting-edge innovation, particularly in the field of technology. And that kind of contrast is very, very exciting. And I think if you and I were bound to meet somewhere, I think Ivy Business School was that place, was going to be that place. I think there's a critical mass of people in that area that were excited by the early days of crypto, the presence of Waterloo University and nearby, and Vitalik Buterin, and you know, the early days of Ethereum back in Toronto amplified definitely the movement that we were seeing ourselves. And there was a lot of exciting stuff happening in Canada at the time.
It was. I remember the time distinctly. We didn't really know how big this would get. I think when we go back and I go back to our meetings, you and I at a small cafe and talking about, you were already thinking about ETFs and that ETFs were going to come online and how was, you know, our business going to be impacted by the ETFs. And it's funny because serendipitously, the ETFs just came online. And, you know, we, funny enough, the authorized participants and the market makers of these ETFs now come to Ledin to source their spot Bitcoin that they need to make markets and to provide liquidity to the issuers, which is funny because 5 years ago, we had big dreams, but I never thought that it would happen this fast and Bitcoin would become this much part of the establishment.
My focus these days is on this notion of decentralization. What is it exactly? Because it's been very much overhyped in the industry and sometimes that led to disastrous consequences. And if we can define it clearly, can we actually measure it? And can we use that measurement to implement regulations, rules that allow the industry to flourish? And related to this notion of decentralization, I'm looking at the notion of decentralized governance. And so I'm very interested in this mysterious acronym DAO. Again, has been very much hyped in the industry, but it's still a very blurry concept. I think a lot of the organizations today that call themselves DAOs are not particularly interesting. They're either not decentralized, or they're not organizations, or they merely reproduce a system whereby people who have a bigger stake on the platform get to vote more, which is essentially what shareholders do when they own more shares in a public corporation. But that we've had for 400 years, so I don't see anything new here. The kind of DAOs that I find particularly interesting are the ones that bring something new to the table. And at the risk of sounding conservative myself, maybe that's the Ivy imprint, I believe that the most exciting cutting-edge DAO out there happens to be Bitcoin. And one reason why I believe that is because Bitcoin relies on proof of work and not proof of stake. And that means that you don't have just, on the one hand, people operating the platform, and on the other hand, people owning a stake, and then they vote in proportion with that stake, which is exactly what we have in traditional corporations with managers who run the business and then shareholders who vote and oversee the business. And, you know, they have a say on who's present on the board and et cetera. Bitcoin has no direct connection between owning the token, Bitcoin currency, and voting. And so Bitcoin operates with an incredible innovation, which is not just separating managers from shareholders, but separating between three categories of people: the users who own some of the currency that is endogenously produced by the Bitcoin ecosystem, the people who run the platform and the ecosystem, including developers, and then this third category of people that is previously unseen, unheard of in history, the miners. And the miners are actually playing a fundamental role in the further decentralization of governance infrastructures relative to the traditional public corporation. And that is fundamentally new and fundamentally exciting. And this is the area that I'm most focused on these days when it comes to academic research and implications for the real world and the real economy out there.
I agree with everything you said. And as a miner, I came into Bitcoin as a miner. That's how I entered the Bitcoin world, because that's what my family started doing in Venezuela. And I found their role on the network to be fascinating. And the way I conceived them was that they were these type of network bouncers that were in charge of organizing all the transactions and protecting the network. That was sort of my very simplistic way of thinking about them. And I think that the work that you're doing is fascinating. And I love the sincerity by which you basically highlight that most DAOs out there today are not DAOs, in the same way I think most decentralized finance platforms out there today are not decentralized, because there is some dude sitting in Palo Alto that you can get on the phone with. And if that happens, you are not decentralized. If you could wave a magic wand on how we could incorporate Bitcoin education or crypto or blockchain education, Bitcoin education into the university curriculum, you know, what would, in your way, be the best way of getting Bitcoin more involved in academics?
I'm going to try and surprise you and take a sidestep to answer your question. I believe that today, Bitcoin education or crypto education or blockchain education is no longer the priority. I believe that the priority today is to teach principles of governance and principles of organizational management to people who are already in the blockchain ecosystems. What I find is a big obstacle for the growth of the industry today is the fact that in many cases, it tends to be dominated by very young people who have a background in computer science, have very little experience working in a traditional organization, have very little knowledge of how governance operates in the real world, and so have a very biased view of what is new and what is not new. And they tend to see everything that is written in code as groundbreaking and ultimately disruptive, even when it is not. And so I feel that today, the priority is not to educate people about Bitcoin, but it's to educate Bitcoiners about corporate governance.
That is a fascinating take. And I will agree with you in that it feels that, you know, this thing was brought upon by technologists, and technologists have done a really great job so far. But I think you have to, if you want to take, if you want to cross the chasm, right, and to put this in the hands of everybody, you have to be able to talk to governments. You have to be able to talk to regulators. You can't just take this. You got to have to, you know, if you don't get Bitcoin, I'm sorry, I don't have time. You know, you can't take that view. That doesn't take us to a bigger tent. You know, that takes us to a tent that gets closed in, and it gets, you know, it's almost alienates other people, right? So I love that answer. I think that's a really interesting contrarian take. And my last question to you is, again, this is a bit of a tangent, but you're the guy that I would love to ask this question to. Do you ever think that we can decentralize teaching?
All right. So to keep this interview and discussion spicy, I'm also going to try to surprise you here. And I would argue that higher education is more decentralized than Bitcoin at this point. If you think that, if you see every university in the world as a node in the education ecosystem, then there are more nodes in higher education than there are full nodes in the Bitcoin network. There's about 20,000 universities in the world today, and probably around 15,000 Bitcoin full nodes. So I think my biggest concern is not decentralization, but I think the point you were referring to is access and the ability to, the cost of setting up a node in a way, rather than the presence of multiple nodes everywhere in the world. And I agree with you that this is a major issue. There's already change that has happened in that today you can get a lot of educational content for free online through various channels provided by corporations, provided by YouTube channels and Coursera and other teaching platforms. But the reality is that university degrees are a credentialing mechanism, and it isn't the same for many corporations and potential employers, whether you know something and whether you know that same thing and have a degree to prove it. And that's what's extremely costly. We live in a world that is still dominated by the power of social status and status signals. And that's why education at the same time has never been so available in a decentralized fashion, and at the same time so expensive. That is a crazy paradox. And clearly it's a big challenge for everyone involved. And as a university at UCL, we are very much talking about this because we have this long history of being an open university. You know, we were the first university in the UK that admitted students independently of their religion, independently of their race, and then later on, independently of their gender. And so we have this long tradition of being as open as possible and being and leading the way and being cutting edge in that respect. And so we are talking about, you know, what can we do today to live by these principles? And it's a very, very complex question. There's no easy answers. But I think if universities, who somehow hold a monopoly still today on the provision of education, even though it's like a, it's a collective, decentralized kind of monopoly, but it's still like the main source of credentials. We need to act soon before one of the many disruptors out there that wants a piece of the pie manages to do it and perhaps does it without the kind of neutrality that you mentioned earlier. I really liked your analogy about universities being a referee in between governments and the broader economy. And I think it's very important that we keep this role as a neutral referee. And if we don't act to increase access, we may lose the role that we have. And society as a result might lose that neutral referee that is so much needed to inform economic development, social development.
Thank you so much for your time, JP. The last question I have is, obviously, after listening, listeners are probably going to want to read your book and go read about everything that you teach and write. Where can people find out more about you?
So they can find me on Twitter at pirateorg, PIRATEORG. And that's based, like you hinted at earlier, on the title of the book I co-authored a few years ago that was called The Pirate Organization. So pirateorg on Twitter, and then they can find me easily from there.
Awesome. We'll put all the links to the book and all of your contacts in the show notes below. Thank you so much for your time, JP. It was a pleasure, and I can't wait to see you again soon.
Thank you so much.
That was an eye-opening chat, wasn't it? I got to admit, when JP mentioned that educational institutions were even more decentralized than Bitcoin, I was shocked. But I've had time to think about it since the interview, and I think he's onto something. He's right that there are more educational institutions worldwide than there are Bitcoin nodes today. And they all run different code, if you will. His point about education being both widely available yet historically expensive stuck with me. It's a fascinating paradox. And he called universities what they are: credential mechanisms, not just educators. By teaching about Bitcoin, universities can equip students with the knowledge, skills, and credentials needed to navigate this evolving landscape and contribute to its future. Many others, myself included, will continue fighting for decentralized and cheaper ways to issue these credentials so that more people can get ahead. Thank you, JP, and I hope you, like me, learned something from this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to rate and subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledn.io. That's ledn.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.